Well, good morning. Good to see all of you today. If you have a Bible, if you would open it up with me to John's Gospel, chapter 4. Yes, we have been in John 4 for a little while, but it's a rich chapter, as is pretty much everything in John. It was about 21 years ago. My kids were little. We were on a beach day at Dana Point. And as was our custom, we would bring all of our children to the showers at the end of the day. And they were all little, so we strip them down buck naked and shower them off right there in public. It's just, you know, this is done until a certain age, right? And our kids we're showering them off. We get little Karis's bathing suit off, and lo and behold, in her lower abdomen region, there's a rather large bulge and in her abdomen. And I'm like, that's not okay. It freaked me out as a dad. I looked at that and I'm like, wow, look at that. And as a parent, you're like, don't show fear. You know, kids can sense fear. And I'm looking at that with her and freaking out inside. But because this is my little Karis. She's three and she's so fragile and so wonderful. What do I do? And so we had a friend who was an OBGYN, and he was the only one that we knew to call, you know. And so we call him, get in the car, head to there. You know, this is back in the days before cell phones, or before, you know, cell phones that weren't this big and really expensive. And we called and we made our way up to their house, and I'm this whole time I'm just freaking out inside, trying to behave on the outside. And we get him to our friend's house, and he takes a look at her, and I'm just like, please no cancer, please no tumor, please no, you know, because your mind just starts to cave in on itself. And he said, oh, it's just a hernia. Oh, okay, I'm familiar with that. And he said, no, that can be fixed. It doesn't need to be fixed immediately, but you probably want to go get it fixed sometime in the next year or two. That was just a huge cumulative sigh of relief. If you're a parent, you know exactly what these feelings go like, don't you? That something happens with your child and you are so connected and so you love them so much that this situation instantly drives you into desperation. Today's story in the book of John is about Jesus and a desperate dad. A desperate dad whose son is dying. And the only thing he knows to do is to make his way to Jesus. Does that make sense so far? Basically, what we're looking at this morning as a overall in this passage is the idea that we need that we can trust Jesus with our most impossible situations, because like he is in this situation, he doesn't even have to be physically present to powerfully intervene, that we can take him at his word. We can take him at his word. His word is enough. Now, Jesus is at the end of a two-day stay on the wrong side of the tracks with a bunch of Samaritan people. He's in no man's land from a Jewish person's point of view. He should not be here by all accounts. But he's found, out of this conversation with a Samaritan woman, he has found an open door, and all the wrong people are receptive to him, and so they ask him to stay, and he stays. Now, it's important to say, to look back and at the beginning of John, because John actually gives us a clue at the very beginning how this story is going to play out. It says in chapter 1, verse 11 and 12, he came to his own, the Jewish people, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, Samaritans and Romans and all these other different people, to all who did receive him, he gave the right to become children of God. Children not born of human will or flesh, but born of God. This is that. And so over and over again, John is parading in front of us people from the wrong side of the tracks, people from the wrong family, people from that should not be people that are in contact with the Jewish Messiah. They come into contact with him, they're changed forever. It's a beautiful thing for you and I, especially as Gentiles. Some of you have Jewish backgrounds, but most of us here are just good, filthy Gentiles. And that we've been included. We've been included. And this was actually God's plan after all. That brings us into verse 43. And I want to pick up reading to you with you there in chapter 4, verse 43. After the two days in Samaria, he left for Galilee. That's an area about 60 miles, 60, 70 miles north of that. Now, Jesus himself had pointed out that a prophet has no honor in his own country. And when he arrived in Galilee, however, the Galileans welcomed him. They had seen all that he had done, the miracles, that is, that he had done in Jerusalem and at the Passover festival, for they had also been there. They had also made their pilgrimages to be there. And so basically what's being said here is that Jesus actually found the place of honor among the Samaritans. And so he's going back into his homeland, and in his homeland he's expecting not to be received well, and instead what's being said is he's received well, but it's sort of a thin receptivity, that they're superficially receiving him because they saw a whole bunch of miracles. He will get to this in just a little bit, and it's actually a fairly powerful thing that's being said, but it's important to say that the Samaritans first heard about Jesus from that woman who Jesus told her about her husband problem, right? And he reads her mail. She goes back to them and says, come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. At least he got the highlights right. And they believe about Jesus on the basis of her testimony. Then they come to Jesus and they say, you know, at first we believed on her testimony, but now we know you. And we believe that you're the Savior of the whole world. And you have this group of people that everyone should have forgotten about. They're receptive. Now they're in the family. Wow. And this is really John's point, is that they don't just believe him because of the miracles. They believe him because they've actually had contact with him. It is about him, not about the miracles. It's about becoming his followers. And then in verse 46, it says, once more, he visited Cana in Galilee. Remember, that's where he turned water into wine. And there was a certain royal official whose son lay sick in Capernaum. So let me set the stage here. A royal official at that point in time would have been from two sources, and neither one of them were good. One of them would be from Herod's family, and Herod's this sort of this sort of person who's the king, who's got Jewish lineage, but he's really not a Jew. He's allied himself with the Romans and ingratiated himself to the Romans to get his way so that he can be everything and he can be rich. He's a guy who's ridden Roman rule into affluence, and the Jewish people hated him. On the other hand, he could actually be simply a Roman official who is somebody that's representing the emperor. Either one of those people, we're still in outsider land. This person is irreligious but desperate. And it says in verse 47, when this man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went to him and begged him to come and heal his son, who was close to death. Here's a man in an impossible situation, absolutely impossible situation. His son is close to death. They don't have all the glories of modern medicine that we do, and even when we do, that doesn't mean that they can change the outcome. He is desperate. His son is dying, and there's nothing that anyone can do. All that he knows to do out of that desperation is to find his way to the stories that he's heard about this man from Galilee who's a healer. He doesn't know all that means, but he does know that people are getting healed that are in contact with this man. And so somehow he's got to make his way. So he hears that Jesus is coming through the general vicinity where he is, and he comes down from Capernaum because actually Cana is about 18 miles from Capernaum, about here to Lake Elsinore on foot. And so he's there. And he makes his way down from Capernaum where his son is sick because he's got to get to Jesus sooner than anybody else can. And he gets in front of Jesus and says, I need you to do something for me. What did he do? He let his impossible problem drive him to Jesus. He let his impossible problem drive him to Jesus. That's really important for us to hear this morning, because a lot of us are facing very desperate situations. In this guy's case, he's probably, his emotions are pretty raw. He feels overwhelmed. I don't know if you've had a chance to body surf and down at Moonlight Beach or in Newport Beach, but those waves are very powerful, and sometimes they just get you and they just turn you over and over and over and plop you on the sand at the end. That's what this guy feels like. He's flailing around in the waves of these circumstances. What normally happens when we run into an impossible situation? Well, most of us emote in some way. We cry. We might just yell. We might get mad. But almost every time we'll seek someone or something to alleviate the impossible situation. We'll go to a friend. We'll go to the doctor. We'll go to a pastor, to an advisor of some sort. We'll go anywhere but Jesus. And I find that, unfortunately for most Christians, that we will spend a lot of time and energy and money and we'll exhaust all of these resources already having put our trust in Jesus, but not acting on the trust that we have in Jesus. And we'll act like functional atheists and we'll run to everyone except for him. And this man, he gets it right. He lets his troubles drive him to Jesus. Back in the Old Testament in 2 Chronicles chapter 20, the people of Israel are surrounded by a vast army. And they're desperate. They don't know what to do. And King Jehoshaphat, that's a great name, but don't name your kid that. King Jehoshaphat, he has a heart for God. And he says this very powerful prayer. It's very simple, but very true. He says, "We have no power to face this vast army that is attacking us. We do not know what to do, but our eyes are on you." We don't know what to do, but our eyes are on you. Would you say that with me? We don't know what to do, but our eyes are on you. That's really important. If you're running into a marriage trouble, let your marriage trouble drive you to Jesus. If you have an alien abducted teen, let that teen drive you to Jesus. If you have a lot of little kids, let those lot of little kids drive you to Jesus. If you've got somebody that you love who has an addiction, let that drive you to Jesus. Do you hear what I'm saying? That he is the answer to any and every situation. This man gets it right. He lets his trouble drive him to Jesus. Because for you, quite frankly, your circumstance might be impossible for you in your own strength and your own resources, but nothing is impossible with God, right? Nothing, nothing, absolutely nothing. That brings us into verse 48. Jesus' response to this is actually interesting because obviously the man is not alone when he's saying this to Jesus. And Jesus looks around at the crowd and he says, Unless you people see signs and wonders, Jesus told them, you will never believe. Now, what he's doing is he's addressing the bandwagon sort of dynamic that's going on here. They want the show. They want the miracles. They want the experiences, not the one that the miracles point to. They just want the show. And I want to tell you, and this is very popular in America, that we like to seek power, we like to seek experiences, but I want to tell you that seeking power, seeking the experiences, only creates fans of Jesus, not followers of Jesus. Fans of Jesus, not followers of Jesus. And Jesus is in the follower business, not in the fan business, and that's what he's addressing here. And so the question quite simply is, are you a fan? Are you more fan or follower? And that's something that every one of us has to do a sonar sounding into our own hearts and say, Lord, what am I here? Am I more fan than follower? And you know that you're follower because you actually do what you believe. You don't just believe something. You actually do it. You actually act on it. That's the difference. Are you fan or are you follower? Again, Jesus is cutting to the chase here. And the royal official said to him, sir, come down before my son dies. Basically, what he says is, look, I get that there's a lot of issues around this. I don't care, whatever. I want you to come for my son. That's basically his response. And Jesus says to him, interestingly enough, go. Your son will live. Go, your son will live. And that's the point of this story. Really important in all of the stories that, in any of the Gospels especially, that you're reading, that all the stories are about Jesus. And it's important for us to continue to focus the lens on Jesus. What's being said about Jesus in this is that Jesus has the power, the authority, and the willingness to speak the healing, to invade the impossible situation without even being there. That's something that is rare, if ever. Without even being physically present, he has the power and the willingness to speak the healing, to invade the impossible situation. Therefore, you should trust him. That's the moral of the story. Please get that. That he's big enough that he is for you. And that he acts on your behalf. So the question that this brings in my mind is, what do you believe about Jesus? What do you believe about Jesus? How you act largely reflects that belief. Do you believe that he's powerful? Then you pray. Do you believe that he cares? Did he believe he's present? That he's active? That he's alive? That he's trustworthy? What do you believe about Jesus that is absolutely true about him? What do you believe? Very important questions. The most important thoughts that you have are the answers to that question. The most important thoughts that you have in all the thoughts that you contain in your entire life are the questions that you think about God. Those are the most important. You see, Jesus is constantly challenging false beliefs in us about himself. He's stretching us. He is expanding our perspective. He's opening our eyes. Remember the story of when Jesus is actually, he gets into a boat with his disciples. They go across the Sea of Galilee, you know, something around the size of Lake Tahoe. And they're halfway around out, and there's a torrential rainstorm. The wind is against them. The waves are crashing over the boat, and Jesus happens to be in back asleep, in the back of the boat asleep. So that tells me two things about Jesus. One, he was tired, right? He was tired, he was asleep. And secondly, that he wasn't worried about what was going to happen. Well, the disciples, they freak out. Lord, we're going to drown. They wake him up, they shake him awake, and we're going to drown. Look at that, we're all awake. There's water in the boat. You see the water in the boat. Boats don't do well with this. Jesus stands up. Well, for one, he says, where's your faith? Don't you trust me? If I said we're going to get over there, we're going to get over there. And then he rebukes. He says to the wind and the waves, peace, be still. I don't think he yells because he doesn't have to. Peace, be still. The very wet disciples and it says that they ask this question, who is this that even the wind and the waves obey him? Some of the older translations, I like the way that says it, what manner of man is this? Jesus constantly is challenging our small thinking about who he is. And John is wanting us to continually get that Jesus is bigger than you ever thought, more caring than you ever thought, more active than you ever thought, more participating, more present, more there, more willing. That he's there for you and that you can trust him because of that. That this is what is true about him, that Jesus has the power and the willingness to invade your impossible situation. And he doesn't even have to be physically present to be there to do it. And so therefore, you can trust him. And that's what the man does. It says at the second part of this verse, the man took him at his word, took Jesus at his word, and departed. Literally, it means the man believed the word that Jesus spoke, and he left. And here's the right response. The right response is, know Jesus, listen to him, but don't just stop there. Believe what he says and act on that belief. Act on that belief. Say that with me. Act on that belief. You see the man's faith by what he did. That he didn't try to further maneuver Jesus. No, 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 no. Yeah, I get that you want to say that, but I need for you to come with me to heal my son. He doesn't. He takes him at his word. Jesus says, go, your son will live. He believes it, and he acts on the basis of that belief. How do you know that you have faith? It's what you act on. It's what you really have faith in. All the rest of it's just mental assent. It's just stowed away ideas in your mind, in your life. But it's that truth that you act on. That truth is the truth that actually is the stuff that you own. That's the faith that you actually have. The faith that you act on is the faith that you have. If you don't act on it, it's just mental assent to an idea. Do you hear what I'm saying? That's really important for us because I think that we're sort of caught with just more knowledge, but the faith is the doing, not the faith is in the doing, the faith is the doing. So if I believe that God is generous and he is provider, then I do that. How do I make that more than just mental assent? Well, I tithe and I give to other people. That's how that faith is manifest. Does that make sense? Does that make sense to you? All right, that's not an appeal to give. That's an appeal to walk in faith, all right? That's how that works. If I say that God made sex good in marriage, but not outside of that, then it means that I work as hard as I possibly can with all the energy that I have and all the energy that God gives me to stay pure until I get married. That's faith at work. I know that I have faith because that's what I do. Do you understand what I'm saying? I'm not saying that this saves you. I'm saying this is how you know that you have faith. If God says that your words are powerful, your faith in that is that you check your words at the door of your mouth and you don't say certain things that you would because you know that your words are powerful. If you believe that God is for your marriage, is for marriage and for your marriage, and he's quite frankly very clear about that, if you believe that, then you let your heart return home. If your heart is out there, if your heart is in your career, if your heart is with somebody else, you let it return home because that's your faith may be made manifest. Do you see what I'm saying? Your faith is what you do. It's not just this idea, this sort of esoteric thing. So, therefore, Alan and Jessica believe that Alan has been called to be a pastor. So they started a Spanish-speaking group to begin to move that into a Spanish-speaking church plant because that's faith. It's just mental assent until you do something about it. Do you hear what I'm saying? I've had, you know, I've sat down and talked with couples living together and having sex outside of marriage. And I've sat down and I've talked to them and said, you know, that's, you know, you're guaranteeing that you won't have God's blessing on your relationship by doing this. They're like, whoa, what do you mean? Well, everybody's doing this. I'm like, so? God has been really clear about this. Do you believe God or you do believe our culture? And lots of them have just kind of looked at me like, are you from Mars? I'm like, yes, I am. But I want to tell you what the Bible really says, that God is not silent on this. He's not unkind at all. He just said that I designed this to work beautifully between in a relationship between a man and a woman in marriage. And you're taking it and making something different. And I'd say about 70% of the couples that I've challenged on that, I just would say, you know, you just need to figure something out. You need to stop living together. And they did. And it put them in hardship because they had gotten used to actually sort of using their income together. But they obey God because faith is in the acting on it. Do you hear what I'm saying? And I think that lots of times we're just sort of in the seed collecting business, not in the seed sowing business. You know, we want to collect the things, you know, and say, oh, that's a truth, and I've got another truth, and oh, thank you, Bob, and there's some more truth, and finally you just got a big, you know, weighed down coat full of truth, but you never actually sowed any of those seeds to actually see something grow up from it. But it's in the doing that is doing that. Now, do you understand that I'm saying that? I'm not saying that this is what saves you. This is just how you live the Christian life. Do you understand that? I'm not saying that your faith and your works in this is what Jesus is saying in terms of your eternal destiny, but it is how living the life of heaven now, it works its way out in us hearing the words of us, knowing Jesus, hearing the words of Jesus, believing those words and putting them into action. So what? Here's the question. What's happening in your minds right now, and I can hear some of your thoughts here, and it's not because I'm anybody special, it's just because it kind of goes with this territory, is that what is it that God is speaking to you that you're not doing something about? That's what's really happening in a lot of you. That God has said, that God has put something on your heart, whether it's don't do that, or do this, or take this step, or whatever that it is, and you're sort of cycling that going on in your mind right now. That's the Holy Spirit challenging those things, saying, now let's put your faith to work, okay? Because faith is action. Faith works, if you'll put it that way. Faith works. What is it? think. Every one of you, it's different. It's not going to be universal for any one of us, but it is God challenging these things because he wants us to grow up. And that brings us into verse 51. He says, while he was still on the way, he believed the words of Jesus and left. While he was still on the way, his servants met him with the news that the boy was living. And when he inquired as to the time when his son got better, they said to him, yesterday at 1 in the afternoon, the fever left him. Wow, this is, you know, so the guy's like, yeah, Jesus actually did that. Now, I think that what I've heard pop religion basically saying here is miracles follow faith. And just I want to say this in passing, but I don't believe that's true. I don't believe miracles follow faith. I believe that miracles, the New Testament communicates that miracles follow Jesus. And faith connects you to the miracle worker. Really important. That's not just semantics. That I think a lot of times we just think, oh, we just got to click our heels and say there's no place like home. And we do some sort of weird religious gyration to think that God is somehow, that's faith. Faith is what connects you to the miracle worker. It's Jesus. It's not some sort of conceptual or abstract idea that you're trying to get fill the tank up till that point. Now you got your miracle. Not a New Testament idea. Verse 53 says, then the father realized that this was the exact time at which Jesus had said to him, your son will live. Now think for a second. Put the pause button on. So the guy comes home and his servants and his wife and his son and maybe his other kids, they're like, he's better. Oh, this is great. Oh, we're so glad that the fever broke. And he's like, you don't understand what happened. How did this happen? This happened because I went to see the Galilean healer guy, and he just said it. And I thought, you know what? That's good enough for me. And I just took off back here. But his name is Jesus. He has a name. And he's calling followers to himself, and I want to be one. Do you want to be one, son? Yeah, dad. Yeah, if he's the one that spoke the word and that got me off my deathbed, yeah. And mom? Yes. And so here's another case of, you know, the Samaritan woman opens up the door to this entire people group. The healing of this one boy opens up this entire family to Jesus. And it's a beautiful thing. And these are people that should be on the outside. But they're not. They hear this word, and it says, so he and his whole family believed. And this was the second sign that Jesus performed after coming from Judea to Galilee. And again, the sign was technically performed in the same place that the first one was, the same place that water was turned into wine, that Jesus spoke the word and he was healed. And so my question, coming to the end of this, is, will you let this sign point you to him? If you are in a place where you're far from God right now, I just want to tell you, you're in the right place. Because God has come near to you. And you're not here by accident this morning to hear this word. Will you open up your heart to him? Will you, just like it said, like I said that in the beginning of John, but to those who did receive him, who believed in his name, who trusted him, he gave the right to become children of God, in God's family. And if that's you today, that invitation is being held out to you. If you're far from God, that can end right now. And that's some serious good news. Serious good news. If you are in the family of God, will you let this sign lead you back to him? To reattach yourself to him and to stop struggling to fix your own problems. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't work hard and that you, but a lot of times we're working without trusting God. And you know what I'm talking about. That we're saying, I got this one, Lord, but you don't got this one. You're not doing well with it. You've basically said, I can be God for myself, but you really stink at being God of the universe. You can't even be God of your own universe. And for us this morning, I want to ask you to come and surrender to Jesus, to take him at his word. And whatever that is, that impossible situation that you're dealing with, I want to ask you to entrust it to him and act on the basis of that belief. Do you hear what I'm saying? And so let's just reiterate for a second what the passage presents to us. That you let your impossible problems drive you to Jesus. Let them drive you to Jesus. Secondly, why? Because Jesus has the power, the authority, and the willingness to speak the healing, to invade the impossible situation. Because he doesn't even have to be physically present to speak the word to see that whatever that is that needs to happen, to see it happen. And so therefore, you should trust him. And this is a word for all of us. And all I've got impossible problems in my life. I have kids. That just goes without saying. And then lastly, the invitation is here for us to know Jesus, to believe in him, to put our trust in him, to believe him, to believe what he says, and to act on that belief. To act on that belief. Now, I'm fully anticipating that this week will be very different for a lot of you because you will actually start acting on what you believe. And you'll see something very different in terms of outcome going on in your life. Now, it doesn't mean that it will be easy because it won't always be easy. It's not a guarantee that your suffering will go away. But it is a guarantee that the resources of God will be at your disposal. Because Jesus is there. Jesus is there in the midst of what's going on with you. And then lastly, working on the not so superfluous question, are you a fan of Jesus? Woo-hoo-hoo! Yay, Jesus! Good miracles! Woo-woo-woo! Okay, yay, Jesus did that miracle. Oh, yay, I like the things that Jesus does. Or I'm a follower. Lord, speak into my life. Mold me and shape me. I'm yours forever. Fan or follower? Which one are you? Let's stand. Lord, here we are. This dad was a desperate guy. And he got it right. He let his impossible situation drive him to you. And you are the God of the impossible. You're the one, Jesus, that said, with man this is impossible, but not with God. With God all things are possible. And so we come to you, Lord, and we let these impossibilities drive us to you. Lord Jesus, we don't know what to do. We're like Jehoshaphat with you. We're saying, we don't know what to do, but our eyes are on you. Would you say that out loud with me? We don't know what to do, but our eyes are on you. One more time. We don't know what to do, but our eyes are on you. And so let's bring those things, those impossible situations. Why don't you just put them in your hands right now, like you have them in your hand, and let's lift them up to Jesus. Lord, some of these things are just dripping with such severe emotions that we have a really hard time even seeing straight. But we bring this to you. We bring our marriages to you. And we bring our future to you. We bring our children and what's going on to you. We bring our finances. We bring our struggles with depression and discouragement. We bring it all to you. All of it. We're grateful, Lord Jesus, that you're powerful enough and you love us and that you're for us. And I pray, Lord, that where the circumstances have somehow communicated inside the souls of many of us, that somehow you are not active and that you are not for us, I ask you, Lord, I want to extract their faith from the circumstances and reattach it to you like a plug. I pray that you would now, reattaching that to you and not to the circumstances, now that you would come in. Would you just say that, Lord, come into my impossible situation. whatever that it is. I trust you. Jesus, we pray these things in your name.